Welcome, everyone. My name's John Crump. I'm co-director of the Centre for International Health at the University of Otago. And it's my pleasure to welcome you all to the 2016 McKinley Oration, which this year bridges the 9th Otago Global Health Institute Conference and the Australasian Society for Infectious Diseases annual scientific meeting, which are being held back-to-back this year. The oration's named for the McKinley family, who generously endowed a chair at the Centre for International Health that I'm fortunate to hold at present. And the 2016 McKinley Oration will be delivered by Professor Sarah Cleveland. Sarah is a professor of comparative epidemiology at the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine, an associate academic at the School of Veterinary Medicine, University of Glasgow in the United Kingdom. Sarah graduated in veterinary medicine from the University of Cambridge in 1988. She received her PhD from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine in 1996 on the epidemiology of rabies and canine distemper in Serengeti, Tanzania. Sarah's research on the epidemiology of zoonotic and livestock diseases has a focus in East Africa, and her research aims to quantify disease burden, identify animal reservoirs of infection, and understand risk factors for zoonotic diseases, as well as investigate infection dynamics in natural ecosystems. In addition to her work on rabies, Sarah's research interests include bacterial zoonoses like brucellosis and leptospirosis, and transboundary livestock diseases like foot and mouth disease. Sarah's also involved in several graduate training and capacity strengthening initiatives with African partner institutions. She's the founding director of the Alliance for Rabies Control, whose mission is to prevent human deaths caused by infection with rabies virus and reduce the burden of this disease in animals. Sarah's received many accolades for her work, and I know she's be embarrassed for me to mention them, but she was awarded the British Veterinary Association Trevor Blackburn Award in 2008 in recognition of her work on animal and human infectious diseases in Africa, and she's both a Fellow of the Royal Society and an international member of the US National Academy of Medicine. And we're really happy to have Sarah with us, spending the month of November in New Zealand as a 2016 William Evans Visiting Fellow at the University. Sarah works with a number of University of Otago and Massey University researchers closely on infectious diseases at the interface of human, animal and environmental health in Tanzania, as well as other low-resource settings. And I wanted to point out that her lecture this evening coincides with World One Health Day, which is a day that promotes efforts around the world to bring together all human, animal, and environmental health disciplines to work together on health problems. On a personal note, I first met Sarah in 2009. My group that was working in Tanzania had recently completed work there showing that neglected animal-associated infectious diseases like leptospirosis and Q fever were much more common causes of severe fever illness than malaria, which was the leading diagnosis for that problem in the area. And so we began looking for a veterinary collaborator to progress that work. And I remember doing a quick PubMed search on zoonoses in Tanzania. If you try to do that, Sarah's name appears very quickly. So I actually emailed Sarah cold in 2009 to pitch the idea of working together on bacterial zoonoses. And I'm sure I don't need to explain to many of you that contacting people to collaborate in this way rarely leads to a response at all, let alone develops into anything. But Sarah, being ever positive and enthusiastic and generous with her time, responded positively. And over the years, I've had the privilege of working with her, our collaborators in Tanzania and teams on an ever-growing and enjoyable program of research, training, and capacity building on zoonoses in Tanzania. So thanks, Sarah, for being a great collaborator. Sarah really is a world authority on rabies, and we're delighted that she's traveled to Dunedin to be with us. So let's warmly welcome Sarah to speak on towards the global elimination of rabies, evidence, interventions and impact. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. Kia ora tēnā koutou katoa. Oh, I can relax now. Thank you very much indeed, John, for those very kind words. It's been a very long-held ambition of mine to visit New Zealand, so I'm really delighted to be here. And I'd like to thank John very much for inviting me to give this McKinley oration and for hosting me here in Dunedin for a few weeks, as well as also for being a fantastic collaborator. Many of you know John, and that will come as no surprise. Just a few other thanks before I begin. I'd like to thank Fiona Gray for fantastic organisation, and she's been superb in setting up the visit here and for this presentation. I'd like to thank the McKinleys for support of this event, and the William Evans Fellowship for supporting my stay in Dunedin. And lastly, to Charles Tustin and colleagues at Abbey College, who've really made me feel so welcome here. And it really does feel like home from home. So the University of Glasgow clock tower there on the right is, I understand, the basis on which the tower here at Otago was modelled. And this is a photo on the right from just a couple of weeks ago with colleagues and students from Tanzania at Glasgow, and this morning from Otago. And we share many things together, of course. We have similarly broad international environment, academic environment and perspectives. And of course, we share the same beautiful, unbroken sunshine in both places. So before I start on the main body of the talk, I also want to acknowledge the many people that I've worked with in rabies. This is just a small subset, but really the key collaborators who've contributed mostly to the work that I'll be talking about today. In the previous photo, you saw Dan Hayden, who's the director of our institute here. He's provided many critical insights into our thinking about rabies and disease ecology more broadly. And Katie Hampson there on the top left, and you'll notice from the publications how critical her role has been in developing the rabies research and now leading it, and she really is at the forefront of the work at the moment. So compared to many of the diseases that I work on, I think rabies is probably known to many people here. They'll have some awareness of the disease, but it is a fatal disease affecting all mammals, including people. It has the dubious distinction, perhaps, of having the highest case fatality ratio. Once clinical signs develop, death is an almost inevitable consequence. The clinical signs of disease can be really terrible. They can progress from a fairly non-specific suite of signs to anxiety, fear, which elapses. People come in and out of lucidity, change of behavior that can be very distressing for people around them. And then the classic signs of hydrophobia and aerophobia that are very distinctive of rabies, and progressing to paralysis, coma, and inevitable death. Several of the other lyssaviruses are also present in a number of different species, particularly bats, and these also cause the disease rabies. So I'm not going to be talking much about those diseases today, all those infections today, but just to say that when I'm talking about elimination of rabies, that's the reason why I'm not talking about eradication, because we have these other lyssaviruses that are infecting bat species. I'm just going to turn this a little bit. So rabies has many different impacts. Of course, we're all very aware of the horrific nature of the deaths, but it also has huge implications in terms of the incidence of sometimes quite severe animal bite injuries that it incurs, and the psychological trauma and the economic toll that that takes. It's a very costly disease. It has a lot of implications for animal health and welfare, both because of the disease itself, but because of the way people's perceptions about animals are shaped by the fear of the disease. And it also has impacts for wildlife conservation. And I'll touch on these points throughout the lecture. But I think the really good news about rabies is that it's 100% preventable. And it has been, actually, for more than 100 years now. And it's thanks to Louis Pasteur, who really developed the first rabies vaccine. And he inoculated a boy, Joseph Meister, who'd suffered severe bite injury from a rabid animal. And the boy survived. And this principle of what we call post-exposure prophylaxis, and I'm going to refer to that as PEP, giving people a course of rabies vaccination and immunoglobulin to passively immunize people after the exposure has proved to be very effective to this day. It's still the mainstay of that arm of prevention. But although it is highly effective, it is very costly. There are millions of people at risk from rabies because of the areas where it's circulating, and it's estimated that at least 29 million people every year are receiving a course of PEP at a cost of $1.7 billion. The other arm of rabies prevention is in relation to vaccination of animal reservoirs. And we have excellent animal vaccines as well to try and prevent transmission and infection at the animal source. And there are several different animal reservoirs for rabies around the world. Different animal hosts, both wild carnivores, domestic dogs, and as I mentioned earlier, bats. So this looks like a very complicated picture. But I think what I want to try and convey through this talk is that actually the epidemiology of rabies does distill down to some fairly simple principles. One of those principles is that despite this diversity, the major burden of human disease, more than 99% of human deaths around the world are due to transmission from domestic dogs, from canine rabies. And these cases are occurring in Africa and Asia, where dog rabies is endemic. So although we have this multitude of other wildlife hosts, when we think about the public health problem, we're really talking about dog rabies. The second principle is that where you have animal reservoirs, whether that's wildlife or domestic dogs, the virus or the variant of that virus is maintained by a single host species. As I mentioned, it can affect all different hosts, but the maintenance of that virus, the host species that's sustaining the circulation, is usually just one host species. And that's important because if you can target that host species, you can eliminate infection. The other hosts are just infected by spillover from the reservoir. And we've seen this in action in France, in Western Europe, for example, where they've implemented wide-scale, very intensive oral vaccination of foxes, which are the reservoir of rabies in Western Europe. And when you vaccinate foxes, even though there are many other host species that can be infected with rabies, you find that rabies disappears not just in foxes, but in all other mammalian hosts. So you've got elimination of rabies in Western Europe. So that those are sort of two key principles to hold on to through this talk. But I talked about rabies being widespread in areas where dog canine rabies is endemic. And it's an interesting question as to why canine rabies, despite the fact that we've had these tools for so many years, is still what we describe as a neglected disease. And it has many features in common with other neglected diseases, and there are many facets to this, one of which is underreporting. When I first started working on rabies, the official WHO surveys, which were published every year, would consistently report about 200, maybe 250 human deaths from rabies every year in Africa. And these surveys and these reports are taken very seriously by ministries of health and used as a basis for priority setting often. And it was very clear to everybody that this was a huge underestimate. And so one of the first things we worked on was trying to come up with a different way to estimate the true burden of human deaths. And we used as a starting point the incidence of animal bite injuries from suspected rabid animals. There are many reasons why human cases aren't reported or don't appear in the records and transmitted to WHO. But many people, when they're bitten by dogs, do recognize the risk, do recognize the need very urgently to go to hospital to seek treatment for the PEP. And these records are usually maintained very well in clinics because of the need to account for the very expensive vaccine. So this was a very useful starting point. And using a fairly simple probability tree approach, we worked from that to estimate the proportion of those suspected dogs that are truly rabid, and it turns out that people recognize rabies very well, and that's around about 70 to 80%. Then, depending on where people are bitten on the body, there's an association with the risk. So a bite to the head and neck is a much riskier bite than a bite to the foot or the trunk. So not everybody that is bitten by a rabid dog will get rabies. If you're bitten on the foot, it's probably something like 5% without any kind of PEP, and the head and the neck, it can go up as high as 40%. And then we looked to see what proportion of people coming to the clinics then received PPE. We assumed that whatever the nature of that administration, they all survived. From that, then we worked out how many people didn't get, who were at risk from the bite of rabid dogs, who didn't receive PPE and who might die. And from that, we estimated this first for Tanzania and found that 100 times more deaths were reported in Tanzania than were estimated than officially reported. And then this was extended to look at the global burden of disease. And using a similar principle, but now much more detailed data from a large number of countries from across the world. And overall, this is work that Katie Hampson has been leading recently. It's estimated that 59,000 people die of dog-mediated rabies every year. You can see those confidence intervals are pretty wide because there are quite a number of uncertainties in those estimates. But by any measure, we can talk about tens of thousands of people every year. And for those of you who are familiar with disability-adjusted life years as a burden, it's also a substantial burden of disease. And most of those, the vast majority of those deaths, are occurring in Africa and Asia, in poor communities, usually in rural communities. And it's a very, very expensive disease because of the high requirements for PPE. And rabies also shares many features that are typical of endemic zoonoses and contribute to the fact that this is a group of diseases that is generally very widely neglected. When you look at the 59,000 deaths and we look at some of the other endemic zoonoses, we heard earlier today about the burden of leptospirosis, which is also 59,000. And we see that these are diseases year in, year out, killing this number of people. So they exert a substantial burden. It's actually about five times the number of people that died during the West Africa Ebola epidemic. But the reason that they're neglected is because they're really not posing a threat to high-income countries. We've had the good tools, the good vaccines available to control these diseases, and so they're not really posing a threat. They don't pose a threat because they don't spread. There's not much human-to-human transmission. And the real tragedy of it is that these deaths are occurring in poor, neglected communities. They're not really neglected diseases. It's the communities affected that are neglected. And it's a sad truth that these are deaths that are passing unnoticed by policymakers and not being prioritized. So, of course, we have to be vigilant and we need to be very concerned about pandemic potential and spread from emerging zoonoses, but we shouldn't forget that this burden of preventable diseases is something that we also need to tackle. And I talk about it affecting poor people, like many neglected diseases, and I think the next two cases really illustrate this point very well. This is a lot to do with where people are exposed, the high incidence in rural areas, but also their access to good, high-quality health facilities. And this is a woman who lives on the border of the Serengeti National Park. She has six children. She acquired a puppy. That puppy was playing with the children. It developed rabies, and it licked or bit every single one of her children. When it fully developed rabies and died, she recognized the risk. She recognized the need for urgent treatment to get her children to hospital. She could only afford to take one child to hospital. And how do you confront and face that sort of terrible choice as a mother? This is a man. He's also, as you can see, extremely poor. What you don't see is that on his back, he has horrific scars from where his daughter bit him when she developed rabies. And the reason she died from rabies is she was bitten by a neighbor's dog in their village. The father went and asked the neighbor if he could cover the costs of her treatment because that is a traditional way of dealing with these. He denied any responsibility. And you can imagine for somebody in his position, how do you raise money to get to the hospital, to raise the funds for transport, to raise the fund to pay for the medical fees, and even if in some cases the vaccine itself is administered free, there are a huge number of associated costs. And this person doesn't have ready cash available. It takes time. It takes time. You have to sell your possessions. You maybe need to go and get a loan from friends or relatives. And it took him 2 to 3 days to raise the money, and that delay was fatal for her, for the daughter, because you have to get the PP within 24 hours. The course has to start within 24 hours. So it's no surprise that people living in remote areas, far from clinics, and people who have can less afford or less access to cash to pay for these costs are those that are most at risk. But the good news is that we know that something really can be done, and we need to look to Latin America, where there's been huge advances and progress in rabies and dog rabies control. If you remember from the map, there are just under 200 human deaths at the moment across the whole of that region, and they've come down in all countries. And this is just figure from Mexico, with very large dog populations. And we see that where you have sustained, intensive, and complete coverage of dog populations, then you can bring dog rabies down very quickly. And importantly, when you see dog rabies coming down, human rabies cases mirror that trajectory very closely. And Mexico is nearly free of rabies. There are some pockets in the south of the country where it's still circulating. But for the whole continent, they're now working towards declaring freedom from the disease within the next few years. So it certainly can be done. One of the questions is, why isn't it being done in these other areas? And it's not as if in Asia, actually, that there's not any investment in rabies. In fact, if you look at the costs that the Ministry of Health put into rabies, they're very substantial. These are focused on providing PEP, so the per capita cost shown in those black bars are the per capita costs of investment in providing human vaccine for people exposed to rabies. But you can see that despite that very high investment, people are still dying. When you contrast that with Latin America, a relatively smaller investment, just 20% of the total cost of vaccine put into dog vaccination, have been much more effective in bringing human cases down. And that's relayed through sort of the higher levels of dog vaccination coverage. And what we see in Asia is that it's the poor people who are not getting to the facility. So those deaths are not occurring in the rich urban centres where many policymakers are located, but they're in remote rural areas. And in Africa, there's relatively low investment in both human vaccine and dog vaccination, and we see as a consequence the highest incidence of rabies. So investing in dog vaccination can be highly cost-effective as a way of preventing human deaths. And we need to rethink this allocation of resources a bit more smartly to get the best bang for our buck, as it were, in terms of health priorities. So some reasons why rabies is not and hasn't yet been tackled effectively in Africa. I'm going to talk mostly about Africa. That's where most of my experience is. And I appreciate that it's not the same situation in all parts of the world, but I think there's some very important lessons for Africa that apply broadly. So one thing we hear all the time is we can't control rabies because there are too many dogs or there are too many stray dogs. It's just impossible. Look at all these dogs roaming around. It's impossible. We can't control rabies because these dogs are inaccessible for vaccination. We can't catch them. They're too fierce. They don't belong to anybody or they run away and we can't get them. We don't have enough resources to do anything about dog rabies. And it's true that government veterinary budgets are very stretched and that rabies, because it's not a production animal disease, is not a high priority for the veterinary services to control. And the human health sector see it as a responsibility of the veterinary services. The veterinary services say our priority is foot and mouth disease or PPR vaccination. And then in Africa, we're blessed in that continent of having such a great, a rich wildlife abundance and diversity. But that's created a perception, and this is actually interestingly true now for many diseases that we're working on, that wildlife are playing a very important role in the epidemiology of the disease, and that there's no point really doing anything about dog rabies alone, because you will always get reintroduction of infection from wildlife, and you'd never be able to eliminate the disease. So we've been tackling these perceptions for quite some time, trying to generate the evidence to see whether these really do apply. And I'll start with the last first, because I spent a lot of my early career in my PhD trying to look at the question of wildlife reservoirs. And I was very fortunate to start off my career working in the Serengeti ecosystem in Tanzania. It's one of the most extraordinary places has a magnificent diversity and abundance of wildlife. And I'm actually glad, John, your children aren't here, because I'm sure they'd be making me do animal noises and impressions for all of these different species. I can do a few, but not all of them. So it's wonderful that we have this wildlife resource. But each of these, as I mentioned, all mammals can infect rabies. So the question is, what is the role of wildlife? But the Serengeti ecosystem is not just defined by its wildlife. There are very large and expanding populations of people and their domestic animals on the boundaries of the park. And if we just, I'll just explain that this is the boundary of the protected area system here, the Serengeti National Park itself in this area. And this is just showing from 1970 to 2000, the expansion of people from the Lake Victoria region moving close to the boundaries of the park. And wherever you get people, you have domestic animals. And this expansion of domestic animals and domestic dogs particularly has created another concern in terms of transmission of diseases from domestic dogs to endangered wild carnivores. And rabies is an example of this, with two highly endangered species, the Ethiopian wolf and African wild dogs, both threatened by spillover from dog rabies. So the Ethiopian wolf, it's probably the major threat to the survival of this incredible species that lives in isolated pockets in the Afro-Alpine Plateau in Ethiopia. And in fact, my first introduction to rabies was through some devastating outbreaks in Serengeti, where successive packs were disappearing and dying as a result of rabies outbreaks. And ultimately, in the early 1990s, that population in the park went extinct. So understanding how these pathogens circulate and persist in complex natural ecosystems is something that I've been very interested in and I continue to be for many diseases, not just rabies. John mentioned that I've been working on canine distemper, which is another dog-associated disease that caused big epidemics and unexpected epidemics in lions, killing about 3,000 lions in the Serengeti. But as you can see, these are complex ecosystems, and trying to unravel the different transmission patterns is quite an undertaking. So I think this is actually just an amazing slide, because this is a rabid dog attacking a lion. I mentioned unusual behavior as a key sign of rabies. This is not normally what a dog does. And in fact, the lion looks incredibly, I will have a whole series of these pictures, but the sort of surprise on its face with this dog running, and the few giraffes standing by, they're also kind of peering down thinking, what on earth is going on? So if you see something odd in a rabies endemic area, that can often be a sign that the animal has rabies. But I won't go into all the details of the work. It's actually taken a lot of different approaches, a lot of different people bringing thoughts together to try and unravel these questions. I'm just going to pick up on a few aspects of this. And first of all, to pay tribute to Katie Hampson's pioneering work to develop sort of contact tracing approaches for understanding the detailed transmission dynamics of rabies. And she was working on the principle that rabies is recognizable. Rabid animals behave strangely, they're recognizable. And when a transmission event occurs, when a dog comes in, bites a lot of chickens, goes in, bites the goats, or chases children or bites people, they're often very memorable. So you can go back into communities and collect quite detailed information about that incident. And so Katie, working on the principle of starting from the point of hearing about these bite incidents, these episodes, either through the animal bite clinics or through community sources, and then painstakingly tracing the different transmission chains forward. And so she's been able to generate the most detailed information that we have on sort of spatial and temporal patterns of cases. And what she's found here is that wildlife rabies occurs throughout the ecosystem. So here we have dog rabies in red and wildlife rabies in blue. And there are no fences, I should have mentioned this earlier, there are no fences around the Serengeti. So wildlife are free to move outside of the protected areas and come into contact with domestic animals. And it's also in these areas that we actually see a lot of wildlife cases outside the national park, the national park being this clear area in the center. But even though we have a lot of wildlife rabies, it turns out when you look at the temporal patterns that these chains of transmission different host species. So we have the domestic dogs in dark blue and then other wild carnivore hosts in the other colours. That you can have a short chain of infection, but it's not sustained into a permanent cycle. So this is an observation. There's obviously lots of weaknesses and limitations with the data, but it's the first sort of indication that perhaps we're not getting long-term maintenance in wildlife. We've been able to generate some data from the viruses themselves, the genetic sequence from those viruses. This is a transmission tree that was constructed using partial sequence data from the nuclear protein gene. And the reconstruction of these transmission networks always place a dog isolate at the origin of it. So we have here this root probability here being a dog isolate. And when you're constructing these transmission chains, livestock fall at the end of the chains, and we know they're dead-end hosts, so that gives us reassurance about the techniques. And wildlife also are coming at the end of the chains. They're not appearing to drive the infection. We also see no evidence for host-specific lineages. So there are actually multiple co-circulating lineages of rabies virus in the Serengeti, but they're not associated with different species. And I've had a very good fortune over my career to work with some amazingly talented people and mathematical modelers and physicists, and they can do extraordinary things with very unpromising data. So these are the sorts of data that we're faced with when we're going to the clinics to get animal bite injuries. And I've already told you there are two really useful things we've done with them in terms of burden of disease and the starting point for contact tracing. And these also actually have allowed us to generate, again, sort of information on this, what we describe as sort of the patch occupancy. So how many villages are infected with rabies during different months? And plotting this out here, looking at the spatial pattern, and see that most of the rabies cases in the villages, this is the Serengeti National Park boundary, and these are the location of the villages and the number of cases of rabies over a five-year period in this study that were reported through the animal bite injuries. And looking at it, actually, I was quite worried because already we were thinking that wildlife probably weren't important as reservoirs, and then we see this pattern where all the cases seem to be going right on the boundary of the national park. But it turns out that when you actually look at the connectivity of these villages and the size of these villages, that explains the pattern of rabies much more closely than wildlife. And comparing different models for looking, this was the approach using state-based modeling, looking at the origins of rabies in these communities, it turns out actually that the model that explained these patterns best was, when rabies is introduced from dogs outside this area and not very much at all from wildlife transmission in the park. This approach has also been useful because it's allowed us to identify which might be the most important communities for prioritizing in terms of vaccination, for example. And we see, again, the biggest village here in the red, the most connected village, is the one that we describe as contributing most to that reservoir capacity. So with the support of and using new analytical tools, we've been able to get a lot of insights from rather scrappy data from the animal clinics. But all of these different pieces of evidence are building up a consistent picture that the epidemiology of rabies in these areas is driven very much by dogs and not so much by wildlife. And so if we look at this sort of scheme of what we think might be happening, transmission dominated by dogs to wildlife with some back transmission and circulation, short-term circulation among wildlife. What we see that if we can control dog rabies through vaccination, we actually have the potential to block transmission to wildlife, and then these cycles will not be self-sustaining and we should be able to get rid of the infection entirely. So we've been trying to test this hypothesis through large-scale interventions. Setting up a vaccination zone around the Serengeti ecosystem and vaccinating through central point campaigns all the villages in this area. And one of the first questions for us is really how many dogs do we need to vaccinate? And this depends on a parameter called R0. This describes how many average cases a single individual will generate. And so if I come into this room with a cold, and you're all susceptible to my Glasgow cold virus, which you probably would be, and two of you develop that cold, then we say the R0 for that cold virus is 2. And it turns out this is described by the expression here, the critical proportion that need to be vaccinated. And the higher your value of R0, the more individuals you need to vaccinate. And this is shows that relationship with some example diseases along it. So for a disease that transmits to a large number of individuals like measles, you have a very high level of R0, and the vaccination coverage has to be very high, which is why there's so much concern. And there has been in Britain, for example, with concerns about the measles vaccination and coverage dropping off, and we see new outbreaks coming through. But you'll notice that rabies is right down there at the bottom. It has an R0 of just 1 to 2. And to control disease, you have to just bring that R0 below 1. And we have many ways of measuring R0. Through the contact tracing data, we have empirical observations of that. So factoring how many dogs each rabid dog bites and how many of those develop rabies. So on average, each rabid dog bites 2.4 other rabid dogs, and 50% of those will develop rabies, so the R0 is 1.2. But there are other ways of measuring it. This is one set of data using the epidemic curves and the way the epidemics play out in different communities. And what you'll see from this very wide range of different examples across the world is that the R0 is consistently between 1 and 2, which is a really odd thing, actually, because these populations have very different densities of dogs. We have the Serengeti, which is relatively low densities, and then places like Bali in Indonesia with more than 200 dogs per square kilometer. And still in Bali, the R0 is 1.2, and we've looked at some data from the Philippines recently with 1,000 dogs per square kilometer, and the R0 came at 1.3. So this is something we can't explain very well at the moment, but the fact is that it gives us a lot of confidence that because the R0 is low, and it's low in every dog community that we've looked at, we should be able to tackle the disease effectively by vaccinating about 70% of the dogs in any dog population across the world. And there's another important corollary of that, because often the mainstay of dog rabies programs has been the idea to reduce, if you reduce the number of dogs, you reduce the density of dogs, then you'll have an effect on rabies. And because that R0 is so consistent, actually you have to bring the density of dogs so low to have any effect that it's almost unfeasible really to be thinking about it. And so indiscriminate mass culling operations, which are often the only tool that people have to respond, and there's obviously huge outcry when there is a rabies outbreak in the community, and the response is often kill the dogs, but it is ineffective, and it's ineffective, it's implemented in a mass culling indiscriminate fashion because the density doesn't strongly influence transmission. Demand for dogs is high. The ecology of dogs is driven by people. It's driven by human ecology, and people want dogs. So what happens if you start killing dogs? They'll just bring new dogs in to replace dogs that have been killed, or they will try and move dogs. And that can actually, and we've seen that in cases like Bali in Indonesia, can actually exacerbate the spread of the disease. It generates animosity and bad will. We need to bring communities with us in these campaigns, not be working against communities. And it turns out, and again, this has been the case in Bali, that the dogs that are easiest to kill are also those dogs that are often vaccinated. So indiscriminate culling has never been effective on its own. In contrast, mass dog vaccination has been extremely successful. We have this theoretical threshold of 70% coverage, and this graph shows data from Tanzania, which supports that very closely. So where you reach a 70% coverage, you don't see any more outbreaks, and the lower the coverage, the larger your outbreaks. And 70% is also that level, which is the optimal scenario in terms of cost effectiveness. And a 70% coverage can generate benefits that are very cost effective in terms of World Health Organization definitions of investment. So it's not altogether rosy. We have a lot of support for the feasibility. But what is the reality? Well, these are the villages around Serengeti. And we see that in the lower density pastoral areas to the east, vaccination, which was implemented in sort of mid-2003, started here, has brought rabies down very quickly. And there are still occasional cases, and all of these that have been documented have been introductions from outside the area. We've had almost no cases of wildlife rabies since that time, either in those eastern communities or in the park itself. Again, a single introduction in the last 6 years that has been identified as coming from outside the area. And so this looks like a very promising approach for eliminating rabies in Serengeti. But you will also have seen that on the western side of the park, it's a very different story. And this intervention was designed really not to address the question of feasibility of elimination, but more about creating a barrier to introduction to wildlife to test the reservoir question. So it's certainly not the ideal design to be looking at elimination dynamics. But what we see is that while rabies came down quite quickly after vaccination campaigns were introduced, it then resurged again quite quickly. And those were linked with this very high rate of introduction of rabies from outside the area. And then a second resurgence in 2011 was linked with low vaccination coverage in just 6 of 75 villages in these areas, in the light blue areas, where there were vaccination campaigns carried out by the district authorities on a rather piecemeal basis. So it can be done, but there are lots of challenges. And this point about needing high levels, sustained levels of comprehensive coverage is very important. And this is something that's been reinforced by the experiences from Bali and Indonesia. And I mentioned that rabies, an outbreak occurred there. It was rabies-free and then was reintroduced in 2008. And the map on the left shows the index case in the south, and then the pattern of spread throughout the island. And that spread was mediated by people moving dogs to escape that culling threat. So the first response was culling. The authorities were then introduced mass dog vaccination campaigns. And my colleague Sunny Townsend was instrumental in doing some modeling work around that. And she found that with her scenarios, that missing even just a very few villages, 3 villages in the island, or less than 0.5% of the communities, if they got missed out in the campaign, it could severely compromise the control programs. So we do have a challenge in terms of the completeness and the comprehensive nature of that coverage. But this just shows the trajectory in the dog vaccination. Culling was started here, but then they switched to dog vaccination here. These are the number of dogs vaccinated. You can see the human cases come down in line with the increasing dog vaccination until it was on the point of elimination again, 2011. And then Sunny looked at the trajectories, and at that point, there was an emphasis on you must sustain coverage. You must continue. And the danger is when you get low, complacency sets in. People think it's no longer a problem. And in this case, vaccination coverage has dropped. In fact, culling was reintroduced, and the disease has actually come back and remains still a problem in Bali. So the sustaining of the campaigns and sustainability is a key issue as we go forward. So lessons from Tanzania, many lessons from actually doing these interventions. Firstly, that in contrast to that perception that we were confronted when we started working on rabies, that most dogs are stray dogs, that they can't be handled. In fact, most dogs are free roaming, most dogs are unconfined, most dogs are owned. And the vast majority, and certainly enough dogs, are accessible for parental vaccination. And we think this applies across Africa. I kind of have a bet, if somebody can find me a really true stray dog, you know. I suspect there are a very few, but they're so small in number in reality, and that they're not going to affect the prospects of elimination in Africa. And these are just some figures recently from Malawi, where dog vaccinations were introduced after there were concerns from the human health community about an increase in rabies deaths. And Asia is a more problematic area. There are a lot more genuinely street dogs in Asia, but still, even in these communities, the majority are owned. So we tend to focus on the street dogs because they're visible, they're the ones causing problems, but most dogs are owned. And it can take a bit more effort than it does in our areas of rural Tanzania, but they can be vaccinated. And I've worked with some amazing vaccinators. You can't even see how fast they're going. It's just this lightning jab on a dog. And you can see these guys here sneaking up on these dogs. And nets have proved very successful in these areas. But it is hard work, and it is actually much, it takes a lot longer, and it's more expensive than it is in many of the rural communities that I work within Africa. But it can be very successful. And I visited Sri Lanka some time ago as part of a WHO mission, and there was real despondence there. They said, well, we have to have oral vaccinations, we have to cull dogs, we just can't manage to do it just through dog vaccination. And in fact, they've been extremely successful in doing exactly that. So we can see that there has been a sustained increase in dog vaccination. As a result, human deaths in the black line has come down. And I think very encouragingly, in the pale blue columns that you might be able to see, the use of human PEP, which as I mentioned was so expensive, is also coming down because people are not getting exposed to rabies to the degree they were. So all of this sort of adds up to the view that rabies is a disease, that it's epidemiologically, logistically, economically feasible to think about eliminating in terms of the canine rabies problem. And as I mentioned, that really equates to the human health problem. So we had a meeting at the end of 2015 at WHO with OIE, the World Animal Health Organization, with FAO, and a target has been agreed of reaching zero human deaths from dog-mediated rabies by 2030. And this is now something that the clock is ticking very fast and we need to move forward. So I think this has been about building confidence, trying to break down these barriers of misperceptions that it can't be done. And it's been so exciting to work with governments and with communities in Africa, because once people start doing this, they go, oh, it's actually quite easy. And say, yes, it is. I'd like to make out that we were really special getting it done in Tanzania. But in fact, it's relatively easy. There are real challenges in terms of operations, organizations, logistics. But it's not an epidemiological challenge. But it needs engagement with communities and other partners. We have some excellent tools. This is a stepwise framework that we're advocating when countries are setting up a national program to try and sort of encourage the idea of incremental steps. It's not impossible to get to the next step and slowly start building up the expertise and confidence to get it done. We're not expecting overnight elimination of rabies, but these are manageable steps and clear sort of guidelines to move along. And I've been particularly encouraged by the example of Kenya. I got involved with an outbreak in Kisumu in Western Kenya. They asked for some vaccine. We provided some vaccine from our Serengeti project. And from that very small start, campaign was started. Champions came out of that process, people who suddenly saw how feasible this was and that it's something that they really could do as veterinarians in Kenya. And so I've been working with the government to set up this national plan for elimination. And the idea is along that stepwise approach. Start small. Don't be too ambitious. Start actually in the easy areas. Don't start where it's most difficult. And gradually build up your expertise and move out from there. And what's great now is that Uganda is seeing what Kenya's doing, wants to follow suit. Nigeria's coming on board. And we hope that we're going to get this sort of domino effect with, oh, we can actually all do this. This is not so hard after all. But there's some key issues about sort of making sure that vaccine is available and providing that startup sort of technical support and encouragement to move forward. Partnerships are going to be very important. We need everybody on board. The animal welfare organizations are critical partners in this, and there are many synergies with animal welfare. And there are many synergies with municipal authorities, with communities, and actually with private practitioners. And there's some concern that private vets might see this as a threat. But I think there are many ways that we can actually bring them on board. This is bringing this amazing clientele to them and hopefully perhaps start some better primary health care in dogs as well. So there are some challenges. PEP, it's great to see that coming down in Sri Lanka. We've seen the cost come down in Tanzania when we start vaccinating dogs, but that doesn't always happen. We're trying to promote a switch from the more expensive intramuscular vaccinations to intradermal regimens. We're trying to work to reduce the incidence of dog bite injuries, because if you're not bitten by a dog, there's not a question of whether you need to have that PEP. And to improve the coordination between the veterinary and medical sector to follow up on cases. So is this really a rabid dog? Does that person really need a post-exposure? And to provide support for clinicians in what can be very difficult situations in knowing whether that PEP is needed. And I'm really interested in this whole idea of sort of using the engagement that we have with communities, the enthusiasm and support that communities have for an intervention like this, to build what I kind of call platforms of trust. And I think there are many benefits and onward benefits that this can generate. And for rabies, it's just one example, and there would be many other interventions you could think about. But rabies has a lot going for it. You're involving the whole community. There isn't any single person in a rabies endemic area who hasn't been touched by rabies in some way. Everybody will know somebody who's been bitten by a rabid dog. And so this is a way to sort of engage with communities, build that trust, build the collaboration between medical and veterinary sectors, and try and improve that sort of surveillance response capacity. It's quite interesting when you read things like sort of lessons from the Ebola crisis. Many of these sort of issues come up, that one of the problems is it's the lack of community engagement, the lack of people who are spanning sectors, and the lack of trust between authorities of different kinds and the communities. So I think there's a lot of opportunities to bring these two agendas together. I showed that figure where we have a big disparity in terms of endemic and emerging zoonoses, huge investment in surveillance and response for emerging zoonoses. And I think it's one of the most effective ways of dealing with that is to tackle the endemic zoonoses, where we can build the capacities in a sort of peacetime, as it were, situation, and we'll be in a much better position then to respond to the crises. So we've been looking at things like integrating delivery of human and animal health interventions, in this case, rabies vaccination with deworming of people in remote communities, which again has brought synergies together between the sectors. And we're quite excited by some recent data that shows that the rabies vaccine actually has a very high thermotolerance. So we've been very concerned about maintaining cold chains, having fridges in communities or fridges in district centres to keep the vaccine. But in fact, this vaccine is pretty robust. And it can be stored for up to 6 months at 25 degrees or 3 months at 30 degrees, which are temperatures that you could imagine being able to maintain in communities. And I think this gives us some exciting ways forward to think about, well, rethinking the way we deliver these vaccines, using communities much more to organize themselves and to deliver vaccination campaigns in a way that suits that particular context, and to sustain the vaccination of coverage, for example, through more regular vaccination of pups, which are being born at a very high rate. And this is just a final slide, really, just to summarize a number of different ongoing activities. There's a lot of work in trying to look at field diagnostic tests and had some very promising results, both with lateral flow assays and with immunohistochemical tools. And I really like the lateral flow assays as a way, again, empowering people in the field and community workers to be part of this surveillance system. And they can generate that result immediately. They can act on that result immediately. You can convey that to your district medical officer or district veterinary officer immediately. And you don't have this lag in the system that I think is really demotivating for people who are involved in this. We're working with WHO to develop criteria for declaring elimination of rabies as a public health problem, working on the Latin America data, looking at ways of establishing vaccine banks, because if we can get vaccine into countries in a reliable way, then I think that's going to be the key catalyst for having these campaigns. And looking at different provisions of PPE, including drone delivery in remote areas, which is probably quite fun to be thinking about. I don't know how generalized that will be. And other reviews of PPE use to try and bring costs down a bit. So there's a lot going on, but it's all moving in the same direction. It's all moving to the idea that this is feasible and we need to optimize the way we think about delivery. So I hope I've convinced you that this is a vision for eliminating canine rabies that is feasible. We shouldn't be seeing human deaths from rabies in 2016, let alone 2030. And over 100 years ago, Louis Pasteur made the statement that to solve the problem of rabies would be a blessing for humanity. And I think that's something that I really hope we will see in my lifetime. And we need all the partnerships and support to bring that together to make it happen. And I really like this quote from Abbey College. I hope I haven't misquoted it, that the motto is pursue that which is precious. And I think for me in my career, one of the most rewarding things has been this work on rabies. For me, this is a really precious goal. And I hope I can come back to you in 2030 and show substantial progress and hopefully no more human deaths from rabies. Thank you very much. Sorry, just a couple of very important things. The funding agencies who, from many different sectors who supported this work. And finally, the various ministries in the government of Tanzania. And really importantly, the communities that we work with on this campaign. So thank you to those people very much as well.
Thank you very much, Sarah. That's a masterful lecture. Some 4 years ago, I visited Uganda as a guest of Tony Wilson, who's a graduate of this university. Otago University, who's a professor of medicine at Mbarara Hospital in Uganda. And so after about a week, I was having dinner with him in the evening, and he got called to the acute ward, and he said, "You better come with me." I was a pediatrician. He was an adult medicine physician, neurologist. And so we went in and saw this young man who'd been bitten by a dog in the local village. He had classic hydrophobia and aerophobia. I'd never seen, well, I didn't know about the aerophagia at that stage, yeah. But hydrophobia is famous to all medical students. It was awful because basically he said, "Well, there's nothing we can do. Let's go back and finish dinner." He got some diazepam, and the family took him home, and he died in the village a few days later. So rabies does happen. I had never seen it before, and I don't think many people even in this audience have probably seen it. I think this lecture that you've just given us really is certainly opened my eyes to the approach for elimination, and certainly it would be a great blessing for the world should that actually happen. It looks like it can be. So really, really fascinating, really hopeful, and a wonderful lecture. Thank you very much. And thanks for this. This is a token of our appreciation. And thank you very much for giving this. Thank you. That's lovely.